Live from the International Debate Research Associates podcast studio in lovely, livable Jamaica, Queens, New York, this is In the Bin, your one-stop shop for all the news and views on debate around the world, brought to you by experts in debate and also the people of debate. We're balanced, all the people. Come on, man. You can get In the Bin in many different places. You can get it on the Apple Podcast, Google Podcast. You get on Stitcher, Radio Public, and of course, anchor.fm/inthebin, where you can become part of the show. Leave your comments, leave your questions, suggestions. Also, inthebinpodcast.com is the blog. You can leave a comment there as well. I'm Dr. Steve Yano. I am a rhetoric professor here in lovely New York City at St. John's University. And what a debate. This is our debate special, another one of our debate specials, last one for the election cycle 2020, I think. Some people on this call are actually pretty excited about that. I don't know how to react to it. First of all, we got a great panel, but I just say that was like not bad in the way I wanted it to be, because now I can't blog about how the Commission on Presidential Debates should be shut down. I got to think of a new argument for why they should. They got their shit together, which is kind of the lead story here, I think, of the whole debate. But joining us tonight, Dr. Kate Morrison from Lil Rhodey, University of Rhode Island, joins us, where she's a professor of debate and argument and rhetoric and all things oratorically valuable in the world.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome. Good to have you on again. You're always a wonderful panelist to have on. Dr. Timothy Barr reluctantly joins us, I think by court order, maybe, from Boston.
I experienced this debate the way that other Americans who watched it, I think most of them watched it, did, which is that you had forgotten about it. You're like, okay, fine. And then you get involved and you get angry, and now, and then you're on a podcast later. So it's just the American tradition.
That is the new America. Is like, I forgot this political event was happening and now I have to be on a podcast. Oh, man. And my grocery delivery from Instacart is coming in the middle of the podcast. How am I going to handle this?
How am I going to replace all my orders? Will they get the right chicken tikka masala this time?
Well, Dr. Timothy Barr researches, writes, and teaches about rhetoric in lovely Boston, Northeastern University. And George Fitzpatrick, former Vermont debate coach, current pundit on all things debate, joins us from his Debate Nerve Center electronic compound in Burlington, Vermont.
Allegedly. I just want to say that I was very happy to see a once proud institution finally pick itself off the ground after it lost all integrity and respect and finally put up a respectable performance. And
now, I told you.
The Giants are currently beating the Eagles.
Oh,
and
good.
Certainly not about this presidential debate.
Yeah, you're watching football at the same time as the debate, aren't you, cheater?
Yes. Unfortunately, I'm not. I have interests other than just watching two old men talk in circles for 90 minutes. Occasionally, I'd want to watch people get brain damage for reasons other than discourse.
Yeah, and football has the two old men talking in circles, the commentators. You know?
Yes, they still do.
The perfect combo.
Joe Buck and Troy Aikman.
Man, I'm glad you...
Drawing circles.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up... that's what the presidential debates needs, is like the John Madden to be like, look right here. Look at what he's doing. Look right here, drawing the big circles and the thing like John Madden used to do.
Yeah.
That's what this podcast is.
I hope. Well, maybe.
Of the debate.
Maybe we should be on Twitch like Ocasio-Cortez. 450,000 concurrent views. Twitch record. We can talk about that in a little bit. But I guess the debates were on Twitch, weren't they? I think it streamed.
In a technical sense, probably, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I was very nervous. I'm glad you mentioned football, because that critique reminded me of that nasty note I had to send you about talking about the podcast performance on the air and not in the production meetings, when you were saying an institution that was once proud has fallen down and brought itself back up. I was getting very nervous. I'm glad that wasn't self-crit. This is not self-crit hour. This is
not a self-crit yet.
No, we're not. George, we're not doing a self-crit episode. We're not doing it. Well, anyway, there's a lot to talk about, isn't there? I mean, normally we talk about the moderation. We can talk a little bit about Steve Scully, if you guys want to. That's kind of an interesting. I mean, it's kind of a non-story. It's typical kind of Trump campaign smear stuff against journalism and against the free press and trying to discredit the press. But you didn't really see Trump try to discredit the press at all in the debate tonight, really, which was unusual for him.
Yeah, I think he was told. My sense is that he was prepped to just be like, it's all about Biden. Like, you can't, you know, we're not winning on these messaging points. Everyone who would have absorbed them is at full saturation. So, and I think that a bunch of things that he did, because if Biden's trying to court the vote of suburban Republican women, or, you know, independent voters, is to say, well, what did he do? He wasn't in power so long ago. He didn't address these things. And so in talking about the record of Biden as a senator and as a vice president, to say he didn't address these things, I think that was the strategy, though that's difficult with coronavirus, because the only thing he has to point to is the H1N1 virus, which I just don't think is like people haven't. It just does not have the same effect.
Yeah, it's like comparing apples to plagues. It just doesn't. They're not very analogous viruses in terms of like their potential effects, in terms of how you'd respond to them. They just like there's nothing like the H1N1 where with coronavirus where you have maybe long term symptoms such as like brain fog or memory loss that might come from just being infected in the first place. Like that's a nuance that's fallen out of like the public debate. But yeah, you're absolutely right about that, Zach.
What does he have to reach for? I mean, H1N1. I mean, it's just you're right. It's not circulating publicly. You really have to dig that grave up to get that circulating. What can he reach for with that? To say you did a bad job. I mean, it's weird that Trump wouldn't mention things like Benghazi. It's weird that Trump wouldn't mention things like Syria and the embarrassment that Putin pulled on Obama with the red line stuff. I mean, it's weird that these things wouldn't come up because these are not analogous, but I'm not a big fan of thinking you have to have some analogous thing. I mean, that's where I do. I think you just have to say, you demonstrate the principles of poor presidential behavior, and that is why you don't deserve it. And I think Trump is trying to say you're corrupt and lazy, and you're milking off the government. It's not as strong as he could be.
That's the whole issue here, where I think this is one of the first elections that I think in my lifetime, probably since maybe 2000, where foreign policy is so actively taken a backseat in the election. Like I've never seen
an
election where foreign policy has mattered any less. Like I sort of made the comment that like just sort of COVID has kind of become like Kate even talked about like the president declaring war on COVID with his new plan. Like it's almost become the new war. It's become the overwhelming national focus in a way that like Syria, ongoing issues with Iran, even what's gone on in Israel like the last few years doesn't really seem to register nationally to anyone that isn't already deeply paying attention to those issues. And it definitely seems like that area of attack, which I think worked well for Trump in 2016 against Hillary Clinton, just doesn't seem to be there in any relevant way against Biden.
I wish I had paid attention. You know, during the we were talking on Discord during the debate, and during the debate I think it was Tim who sent that nice link about the rally. And I wish I had looked at what he was saying at the rally, because what I'm noticing with the rallies is he's moved away from the economic indicators arguments, and he's moving more towards like, I'm the best president ever, I'm awesome, I get great ratings, I know what I'm doing, I'm strong. He's not doing the kind of like, you got totally screwed by the professional politicians with these international agreements like TPP and NAFTA and all of that. And he should, I think you can still milk that stuff and generate buzz.
He did a little bit with his taxes, I think, sort of talking about, but again, that doesn't work as well as what you were describing.
His answer to the tax claim was actually pretty good, I thought, which is, he said, I paid him in advance, which I think, like, as we were talking earlier, I think it's like that makes sense to people, that's easy to understand. I paid him ahead of time. They wouldn't show up or whatever. I mean,
this is what he said. This is a little bit of what he said at the rally in Erie, which maybe challenges some of your characterization.
Yeah, I'm curious about it because I don't know. That would be my guess, but let's hear it.
He says, this is an election between a Trump super recovery and a Biden depression.
Oh, there you go.
You will have a depression the likes of which you've never seen. If you want depression, doom, and despair, vote for Sleepy Joe and boredom. And I think that it's more that kind of like, yeah, that holding together of characterization of like all of these kinds of predicates that are both personal predicates, but because of like, because it's the presidency, those personal predicates will become your experience. And I don't know, like, I don't think that that's a worse strategy. Like TPP, I mean, first of all, that didn't get passed. That was scuttled. Even if though Obama wanted it, the Obama administration had fought for it. But I think that like the kinds of really clear economic indicators, Joe Biden in the debate pushed back on that. He was like, as George, you were kind of pointing out on our chat about it, is that he was like, in Scranton, no one pays attention to the stock market. So I think both parties kind of realize that even if you get a Biden presidency, there's not going to be, I'm sure that they're not expecting a quick recovery. So there has to be, I don't think that's a point that either party really wants to push on, except to kind of blame the other one. Nobody's got a plan.
I think something interesting has kind of happened a little bit when it comes to that, and this might be overstating it a little bit, but in the same way that you sort of talked about, Steve, that a normal Republican line of attack is to sort of attack the media as having a particular bias, I actually think then we've started to see with sort of the increasing conversations about income inequality that economic indicators such as the stock market, such as unemployment rates, such as like also get attacked kind of by the Democrats as not really showing what the economy is doing. Like that's true. I think like their fake news is sort of, well, ignore what the stock market is doing. It's just the millionaires and billionaires making
that is a money. That's a trope that both parties can employ. They can say, well, that might be what's going on Wall Street, but let's look at what's happening on Main Street. And we've heard that in many election cycles. Yeah. As a nice trope to say whether you want to move closer away from that.
Usually when you're not in power, you say that.
Yeah,
look what's happening on Wall Street. But Main Street, man.
Yeah, right. It's rough. It's rough out there on Main Street, USA. It's rough.
A lot of traffic.
Yeah, a lot of traffic. Nobody's going anywhere. There's no jobs. Yeah, I think it's interesting that I think this is all kind of interesting stuff. I think that the thing about if he said that at the rally, why doesn't that come out in the debate stronger? I mean, Trump was like, at first, I really thought he was killing it. I really did, and I put that on Twitter like a fool, and you know, here come the libs, but you know, I got the here comes the liberal alarm, but I do
worried you're trying to own them.
Well, no, I'm not trying to own them. One of the ways I was trying to think about the debate to make it interesting to me is, you know, what could you say or what could you advise a candidate to say that would cut against the natural inclination of this debate to support what you already feel? So these are like kind of incredibly loaded, performances that are meant to, I guess, supposedly convince people on the other side or people who have doubts, but they don't really do that. They just kind of give more reasons and galvanize the ideas people already have. So what could you possibly say that would cut against that natural inclination to see your person as awesome or not? And I was thinking these, I think one way is these big sort of totalizing claims that kind of suck up the specifics of what's being debated. So like when they get into the details on healthcare and ACA, and that gets all complicated. We're talking about Biden care, whatever the hell that is. And that was the worst naming ever. He should have called it Joe's Gotcha. Or he should have called it Come On Health. Come on, Health. That would have been even
compromised
better.
Medicare.
Compromised
version Medicare. 2.5.
Yeah.
There has been a non-compromised version of Medicare to compare it to.
I mean, you know, I'm in a household with someone who has Medicare, and it's a far better coverage than her employer-based one. And guess who her employer is? Harvard, like one of the Harvard hospitals.
There you go.
Where she works. So, I mean, I'm not sure. Like, I think that Medicare really does actually work for a lot of people. It's pretty good coverage, but. It's this idea that, anyway, the policy obviously isn't what's important here, but even the marketing of it, they couldn't give something good on that. It is disappointing. You feel like, cause that's not something that he would have forgotten if they had like a term for it. He didn't come up with that on the spot. That was what they went with.
I know. That's what's really sad about it. I think that's a great point, Tim. That's what's really sad about it. But let's think about it like this. Let's say that the candidate is getting into this like point by point. No, you're going to be able to do this. You're going to be able to pick this. And it's like all these like claims that can't be verified. And they're just shooting back and forth. Isn't it a good strategy to back off and say, well, look, if this is such a good idea, why didn't you do it? You've been in office for 47 years. Why didn't you do it? Why didn't you take any action on it? Why do you vote for wars, Joe? Why weren't you working on this? Why weren't you advising the president to do this? And I think that, like, for people who are kind of, you know, low to mid information voters, that's a moment where they can go like, yeah, why is this a new place? Yeah, you've been around for a long time. Why is this the first time we're hearing about this? Now, high information voters recognize that as a strategy, right?
But yeah, like mid to low is what I'm thinking. To about. That in this case, right? It also followed up on Trump's discussion of the individual mandate, which is actually something that people know about Obamacare, and it's something that they know is bad and they
yeah.
don't like.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So we have like in that kind of progression. Right. That recognition, not only that this is sort of like, you know, that you are not acting, you didn't act then on the things that you say you will do now, but also the thing you did then sucks. And I got rid of a thing that sucks that you did.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a double whammy. That was good. He's like, but, you know, it's like very casual, too. Like Trump was really in good form tonight. He's like, yeah, you know, I got rid of it. It's in court now, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the first, I would say, 30 to 40 minutes of this debate performance for Trump were easily his best debate performance I've seen in any context.
Republican primaries, those first Republican primaries.
Oh, I mean, kind of, but even...
That was great.
I actually, yeah, I do think that he did a remarkable job of kind of staying on message and... I think doing the thing that you were describing, Steve, which is just reminding us that this is not – that Biden is not some new candidate with fresh new ideas. And he has a record, and he has a record that quite frankly has quite a few holes in it.
More importantly, he's lying.
Yeah.
He's just there to – he's just a grifter. He just wants to get elected so he can get money from the government again. But let me push on this, George. Do you think Trump's performance was actually – this is like Futurama Fry meme. Was it actually a good debate, or was it actually good that what Trump did, or was it just good because our expectations were so low?
Both? I think it depends on what you mean by good. If it's good as in it's going to get him back into a race where he's down 8 points and only like 6% of voters are undecided, I'd say probably not. Is it like... at least functional? I don't know if like it's that much worse than what we saw from Pence like in the vice presidential debate. And honestly, we were fairly positive about that for the most part, even considering some of Pence's lack of substance at times. So yeah, I'd say it was at least a decent performance. Would it go into the pantheon of great rhetorical debate performances? No, but it seemed like he seemed much more functional in terms of explaining his ideas, explaining his policies, and probably much better explaining the problems with Biden's record, way better than I've seen from him in a long time.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. I don't think he did well at any of that stuff, but I did like the repetition of the, well, why haven't you done it yet? I liked that.
Yeah, I think that this was a good performance insofar as it was able to fulfill, I think, a lot of really basic goals, right? The first one is, at that point, Trump looked weak, right? So for his own base, he actually has to look like he's there, he's not dying, that he is in control, right? And I think that what we saw there was enough of an aggressive and with it performance that says, he is still sort of in charge of his faculties, but is not so rude that some of his more well-heeled suburban supporters are put off by it, right?
Yeah.
So I think that works well. I also think that what was very successful here was the consistent use of insinuation, right, to wind up putting Biden in a defensive position through large chunks of the debate, really sitting there and trying to respond to charges that he should not be talking about, and that Trump does a good job of just provocation after provocation after provocation drawing Biden into repeating claims that are bad about him.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. That's right. Because the way that Trump was making the attacks was sort of opaque and unclear, it led Biden right into sort of knocking his head against the wall to deal with, like, the claims about, like, the Ukrainian laptop or whatever got –
as soon as he starts to say, like, well, let me tell you about Burisma. Like, no, don't.
You don't know that word. You don't know what Burisma means.
I mean, that's why I think the strategy on that is just a fallacy. What is it? Tu quoque, right? That fallacy works here, right? It's like, well, you did it too.
And I think that was a large part of the Trump strategy, right? To just make a lot of things awash for some of the people that they're worried are getting squishy, right?
Yeah.
That so long as it looks like there's basically corruption on both sides, there's basically self-dealing on both sides, that there's mismanagement on both sides, that's really enough.
And there is. And I think one of the surprising things about what Trump didn't do tonight, and you kind of prefaced this a little bit, Steve, when we talked about Steve Scully, and we've all been talking about it, which is how he didn't go after the media here. And the Scully opportunity that he passed up must be from the internal numbers that they have within the Trump campaign saying this stuff is not playing with the voters we were trying to win, accusing the press. Because how easy would it have been for Trump, and how comfortable, and the kind of thing that he likes to do, which is to be like the moderator that was supposed to be here, you know, he lied, he said it, you know, like just kind of have gone off on one of
he
these
worked, he worked and for he, you Joe Biden he worked for you
right yeah and said all, all of that yeah. all of that and he didn't do that. And I think that usually when Trump talks about the impeachment that happened, which is still related to this issue that's ongoing. I mean, he dismissed it. He's like, I can't believe we're still talking about it, even though he's bringing up the other side of it. I think that usually he uses that as a moment to impugn the press's objectivity, and he didn't do that. So to me, that says that Trump's campaign is very worried and they're trying to discipline him and probably have found a way to discipline him.
That's what I want your thoughts afraid. On. I want to know mm-hmm. your thoughts on who the hell he's listening to.
I think he's looking at his, because one thing he's always been obsessed with even before he's the president is the ratings numbers.
That's true.
Of his TV shows, of everything. And so that's stuff that he really responds to. And so for almost all of his presidency, he's been doing pretty well above average and has been able to explain what he's losing or where he's losing as being unfair press. And I think that people have finally gotten, they finally, partly because there is an election come up and he could lose his seat, they've been able to tell him a story to saying, here's who we need to win and here's who we don't have. And you are losing ratings and you are dropping and you are failing. And I think also, having had that experience with COVID limited some of his possibilities of what he could say. So I think both of those things has put fear in Trump so that he is, while still an undisciplined and totally vile human being, he has enough self-awareness and self-canniness to know that there are certain things that he can't touch on, even though that he has all those habits and that's what he wants to go and let rip on. But he'll do that at the rally. So he's not going to stop doing that. He's just going to do that at the rallies rather than at the debate. Yeah. He only has one more debate to get through. So,
yeah, I mean, I think the fact that he lost the ratings battle in the town hall to Biden by, I think, about 3 million viewers. I don't remember the exact number. It was something like 13
it
and a half.
It was very high. 10 and a half. I haven't seen the Nielsen numbers on that, but it's very high.
Right, but like that's exactly, I think, what Tim is talking about. Like that sort of humility that like that might have been like the sort of trigger in his head to realize that he's not winning this. And
Trump has no humility, but he is sensitive to humiliations.
Yes,
and so I think
if we can make that one word and like humility and humiliation one word, humiliation. I think what's at work here.
I'm certain the ancient Greeks have a word for this. They always
Germans
have,
definitely do.
They always have words for this kind of stuff. The Germans might be a good second choice. Yeah. Anybody knows, put a comment. That'd be great. I'm sure there's a word out there for this.
I mean, let's take a second to at least recognize the absolute ludicrousness of the competing town halls and how just kind of perfect that moment was. Because I think that, like, to link back to where we began this conversation, right, about saving Committee on Presidential Debates Council, what have you, commission,
the commission, yeah.
Ones, that sort of competing town hall moment, I think even more than the bad first debate, was like the full reveal of their own humiliation, right? That this is nothing but some sort of empty ratings grab that is happening, right? It was sort of laid bare. And so I think that part of the win for them tonight is that they can make it like last week didn't happen.
Oh, that's a good point. Do you think that we could, do you think you can look at the town halls as a debate? Do you think they can be looked at in the same way we're looking at tonight's event?
I think that they are what tonight's debate really is. right, I think that there's some, they're like the, I don't know, evolved Pokemon form of it.
Tap B as fast as you can. Real kids
and
know.
So, you know, to the extent that, like, are they debates? Like, absolutely not. But, like, was tonight's?
Yeah, I'm just wondering. I mean, I don't think it's useful to say if anything is really a debate or not. But the perspective of calling something a debate is like magic. It does something to that text. So I wonder if you say, well, the town hall, the competing town halls were a debate, does that alter the way people view them? But, I mean, I like your analysis. I think it's absolutely right. Like, the revelatory nature of that was kind of astounding. I only saw the clips. But, I mean, I think that's the way a lot of people are consuming this election cycle, is through a lot of clips. You know, yeah. they're pretty tired, they're pretty angry, they're pretty frustrated, regardless of what side they are. And, I have friends who support Trump and are really into that, and people who are really into Biden and people who are really not into Trump and don't like Biden, but they're voting for him anyway.
I mean, so, that's the way people consume everything. And I think they've consumed it that way for a long time now. I think,
well, there's high information voters, like, and there's low information voters, and then there's people kind of in the middle. But I think high information voters are people who will watch, like we did, people who are like, I don't know, have serious problems and watch the entire debate, like we did, for whatever reason, like political junkies, the Chuck Todd Juniors and such. But then I think that the majority of people are mid to low information voters, and they're just watching CNN and getting that same clip over and over and over again. And I think the most damaging thing to the Biden campaign that I can think of that happened tonight is the fact that Trump was calm and cool and deferred to the moderator. That's the clip that's going to cycle 2-1 versus anything Joe Biden said.
I don't know. I mean, it depends on... I think that one of the things that suggests to me a little bit that there might be some problems with this debate for the Democratic Party is that afterwards, the spin room that I was watching, they're like, doesn't really change anything. Strong performances from both. Like, I think that there is enough bias within cable news that if they're saying strong, if they're saying anything about Trump that's not negative, then that's not a good sign for Biden.
Yeah,
but I don't think it really ends up mattering. I don't think that it ends up mattering because I don't think that the people that, I think that, I mean, this has already been discussed on the podcast, and I don't want to rehash it out, but that it's less about convincing people than it is about kind of just reminding people that this is happening. Yep. Like, I watched the debate tonight with someone who was like, what's fracking? Like, I think it's just, yeah, like, people forget that people have a lot going on. They got a lot of different, coming from a lot of different angles, a lot of different places. And even though we Minow's kind of position that these are information sites is probably not true. Yeah. I think recognizing that they're also not sites of persuasion and probably even couldn't be were they to be performed better is also, they're really just almost like reminders. They're push notifications, long, boring push notifications.
But that's still persuasion. Drag 'em, Tim. I mean, it's not, it's maintenance. It might be modification. It's certainly not conversion, which is sort of the way that we're trained to think about debate and the way we're trained to think about these things. But, you know, just maintaining sort of the bases that already exist there is a persuasive function, and making them more likely to, you know, fill out the ballot that's sitting on their kitchen table right now because it got sent to them, or that they requested 2 months ago and still haven't gotten around to. That still counts. And it's still, and if all this has done is reify both sides at this point, then that's a huge benefit to Biden, even if he didn't come off all that great rhetorically.
Like, not only does it still count, it's the only thing that counts. And yeah, I think that's kind of why you get the kind of debate that you do. It's the only thing that counts is "come on, man," or
"yeah,
Sleepy Joe."
Right.
And it, you know, that's why I wish I'd spent my night in some other way. But it's nice to see all of you.
Yeah.
Hello, you gotta, everybody.
You gotta speak to him, Joe. There's a lot of weird whisperings in the microphone from old men. Very on point for Halloween, not very good for debate. Here tonight in the Bend election special, Dr. Kate Morrison, Dr. Timothy Barr, and the Honorable George Fitzpatrick joining us.
Did they get elected to the Senate recently?
Honorable? I don't know. Did you? Allegedly.
I hope not.
This might be I don't know if this is persuasion or a push notification, but got to take a break. Anchor.fm/InTheBen for all of your debate podcast needs. After the break, more conversation about the third and final debate of the 2020 presidential election. Right after this, stick with us. All right, In the Bend back after a break. Thanks for sticking with us. Presidential debate number three, but really number two, because number two got canceled. And so this is debate number two? I don't know. Dr. Steviano here, hosting In the Bend, the podcast about debate. We are in part two of our special edition coverage of the presidential debates. Anchor.fm/InTheBend. You can also hear it anywhere where fine podcasts are downloaded and RSS pushed to you. I just really don't care where you listen. Just make sure you listen and pass it on to your friends if you like it. Now at anchor.fm/InTheBend, you can leave us voice comments about anything we say here. We'll address it. We'll deal with it on air. We'll be happy to talk to you. Leave a voice comment there. You can go to the blog inthebendpodcast.com and leave a comment there if you like to type. Who doesn't like to type and produce text on the internet? There's just not enough of that. Back with George Fitzpatrick, Dr. Kate Morrison, Dr. Timothy Barr. I don't know where we go from here. I mean, we can't really complain about the moderator, can we?
Well, I think that...
That's a tradition on this show.
One thing that's interesting about these debates, to sort of think about them as, I don't know, a communicative event, is in part that they signal what ruling consensus positions are, right? And then set up the terrain for the debate. And to a certain extent, it's not surprising that we see so many of the questions sort of posed in austerity terms, right? That there is no kind of social good kind of spending that does not trade off from some other, right? How are you going to make the hard choices?
Yeah, that's a good point.
And that, to a certain extent, like, that's perennial. But I think that there is something very interesting about its signaling, given where we are right now, right? One of the things that amazingly really doesn't get articulated in the COVID conversation is the position that states are in right now, which is dire. Like, it's really dire. Without further federal support, you're going to be seeing, I mean, states cannibalize their budgets. We're missing at least a third of our revenue, right? That at a moment like this, that kind of signaling becomes particularly concerning, I think. And I think that there's also something going on at the same time where so much of the conversation also sort of pivoted very quickly to this post-COVID world that everybody agrees is quite close. It's just a question of, like, how many months in between is different here.
Yeah, it's here already, but how many months do we have to go?
Yeah.
But it's going to happen.
And so, like, I think that the combination of all of those things, I think I find concerning as an indication of where that ruling consensus lies.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Maybe, do you think this is a conflict between sort of journalistic rhetoric and journalistic principle and the principles of good debate or constructive debate? or debate worth having, because I just maintain that journalists are bad moderators. Now, there's some people who take the position you don't need moderator at all. Maybe we should go back to the League of Women Voters panel of journalists asking questions, and then the debate occurs around those questions. There's no moderator. I don't know. But I think journalists are a bad choice because they can't help themselves. They want it to be like 60 Minutes or something. They're like, this is their dream. They're one-on-one with the two most powerful political figures in the country. They can't help but push their kind of like to get that answer, to get that David Frost moment.
And they also don't have like a super wide repertoire of sort of ideas or like tropes, right? Or other ways to be able to articulate kind of places of conflict. So they have to go. Part of the reason that we hear the same austerity tinge questions that would not have been out of place in the 1980s, right? During a debate with Reagan, is in part because there just aren't the inventional resources to think of another question
to
ask.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, because all the invention comes from what circulates in the media and what sells papers, what gets the lead. Right after the commercial break. Kind of sad.
I don't know. I mean, I think that there are other arguments out there right now. Stephanie Kelton just put out her book, which is, and she's a modern monetary theorist and the myth of the deficit. Now, this is the idea of the book. I don't think it's from lack of those arguments are available. There's many different versions of those arguments. And I don't think that the journalists are completely unaware of that. I think it's a matter of interest and advantage. But if there is a kind of rhetorical part of it, maybe it comes from the journalistic habit of making a challenging, quote unquote, challenging question be about, you have said this, like taking a quote, which seems to kind of have already a commitment implied in it, and say, and then bring in a fact. And so this formula of like, you have a quote, how about this fact, address the thing, the commitment that you've made in what you've said through this fact that I've just kind of thrown at you. And the thing is that the response is almost always the same. The person says, look, Joe Biden always says, look, and then he just kind of comes down to his principle. And then he says other facts that kind of conform to it. And I think that is that sense of challenge that doesn't begin from like the concerns of people who are in the audience, the concerns of people, but rather from the quote of what someone has said. It's like a potential possible challenge. Of course, that's also something that comes out a lot in debates. That is a way that people debate one another. But when the moderator frames a question in that way, rather than like, how are we going to respond to what is ahead of us? It's always about kind of prior commitments and the prior commitments of speech. So in some sense, the journalistic model is to be highly attuned to kind of commitments of speech that people have made. Journalists are always trying to get their quotes correct. They're trying to get quotes. They're trying to get what people say. They're trying to get it exact. And that kind of precision about speech and the commitments that are implied in it, that's maybe a big part of the journalistic ethos that limits their inventional resources. But I think that in terms of the politics of it, it's more active. It's a more active non-inclusion of, whether it's through the Commission of Presidential Debates and their non-inclusion of other parties, or through the networks themselves who don't want to bring on people who have alternative economic viewpoints. I think that's much more conscious from the level of the executive, media executives.
Yeah, the Commission on Presidential Debates has huge latitude here, because the networks can't have a debate if they don't have a bona fide news event to cover by FCC rules. So they have to rely on them in whatever they're going to do, and then the parties have to kind of work with the commission. The commission's pretty lightweight, though. But on this question of what you said, I think was totally fascinating, which is this idea that the journalists are relying on what's familiar to them to kind of construct these questions. And it seems as if you've picked people to frame the debate who are interested mostly in what we might broad brush call forensic rhetoric, accuracy of what's happened in the past. Did this really happen? Did you really say this? But the forum is deliberative. What are we going to do? What is your plan? And I think that's
exactly it.
I think that's the essential contradiction of why journalists make bad moderators, because journalism is couched in that kind of precision in a forensic sense. Like, did you or did you not say this? You said this. Can you continue to say this given this set of facts? Well, look.
And that's what journalistic ethics understand. kind of yeah, like journalistic ethics kind of informs that interviewing style, which, you know, and that interviewing style then becomes the style of moderation. I think it is right. Exactly that kind of question of past commitments. And that becomes kind of that part of the hypocrisy circus. And it leads to a broader cynicism and apathy within a populace that comes to politics through this kind of journalistic mediation. Because what it turns out is that, yeah, of course, nobody is held to their commitments. And that's kind of the one thing that you'll hear everyone agree about, which is that politicians don't keep their promises. And that people who do keep their promises are therefore not politicians, because some people are like, Trump kept his promises. Okay, whatever. But they're like, oh, because he's not a politician. And they're always an exception to the rule. And I think that comes partly out of, you know, other motives, other experiences that people have, but it does partly come out of the journalistic kind of performance of like, I ask the tough questions, and those tough questions are always trying to find someone be hypocritical rather than like the evaluation of, is this person creative? Is this person, you know, does this person perform a sense of understanding towards you? It's more about, did they contradict themselves from their past statements? And that's the most challenging thing you can put forward to somebody.
And then after they prove it, then they turned and they like your response to the other candidate. Like, what are you supposed to say?
It does seem very like, prosecutorial now that you kind of say it out loud, where it's more like they're lawyers trying to prove a witness made a contradiction as opposed to sort of being I don't know, gatekeepers for sort of standards about what a president should be focusing on or what the country is currently focusing on. And
yeah, I mean, it's a great point. Back in the day, teaching new debaters in the United States, and you're trying to get them to go to worlds. Back when you were a student and before you were a student, back when the whole thing was new, it's all kind of a hodgepodge now, I think, in worlds debate. But back in those days, it was very difficult to take people who had any high school debate experience in the United States and make them into even like competent worlds debaters. And that's exactly what you're hitting on there, is that our model is the court, is criminal court is our model of what good debate looks like. And our high school debate models, whatever they are this kind of courtroom kind of thing. Even in policy debate, there used to be the judicial paradigm. I think Kate will remember this. She's a debate historian like me. The judicial paradigm where the resolution is on trial, right? The status quo is on trial, and the affirmative prosecutes and the negative defends. And it's the same kind of – that was a very common standard for judges to have, maybe in the 70s, 80s. And then you go to do worlds, which is based on a parliamentary sort of sense of argument, which is creative, cooperative – backbenchers, frontbenchers, minority parties, coalition parties. And there's a different, entirely different set of arguments there that don't make any sense if you're in a legally based model of argumentation, which is kind of interesting. They do kind of sound like they're relying on that legal model in a weird way. And then you look to the history of the deeper history of debate. What's the most popular debate motion at the colleges from like 1700 through even 18, like it's almost as popular as poor man's bees in medieval times for declamation, which Tim might be familiar with. But it's the topic, the bar has produced better orators than the pulpit, or the flip of that. The most popular topic. That says everything you need to know about where people think good models of debate come from in this country. And we're leaving out a lot more than we're including there, folks. Like, wait, lawyers are not good orators. They're just not.
I have an important question here. Was the motion that you were talking about like poor people's bees, like were we trying to give the poor people bees? Were we taking them away? Like what was going on with that?
Dr. Barr.
It's neither. the bees die.
The bees
are dead. It's kind of a whodunit about the bees' death. Who killed the bees? Did the bees get
so the
killed?
Poor people are killing the bees?
No, it's not, we don't need to go into this. I agree with what Kate's saying. I just think that specifically on the economic point, that there are other motives at play that might be more conscious than just habitual lack of creativity.
Who do we have moderate? I mean, if we're all in agreement here, who's a good choice? I'd say Nobel laureates, American, you know, the Nobel laureates come out around the time that the debates are going on. Have those people do it.
Paul Krugman. That's who you mean, right?
Oh God,
that's he's a Nobel laureate. See that like that people like we still pretend like these economists win Nobel prizes, even though it's just like a separate thing they set up for themselves. I can't believe we let them get.
Has Trump been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize every year since like 2015?
Yeah, maybe even earlier. I mean, I don't know. Trump University was a peaceful place. Nobody was there. It's kind of like when you know the old story of the guy who finds the genie and his first wish is for world peace, and then genie's like, no problem. Like, this is kind of like, you know, not genies from cartoons, but actual genies from fable. Yeah, no problem. And like eliminates everyone else in the world. It's like, there you go. It's problem solved. That's your wish.
Wait, so the original genie was Skynet from the Terminator?
Yeah, they're just kind of jerks. Yeah. They're like tricky jerks. But anyway, if you were trapped in a bottle your whole life, you would be too. Anyway, I don't know how we got off on this. This is probably my fault. But who would we have? Do you think that Krugman would make a better moderator than what we saw tonight?
No, but I was kidding about Krugman. Just to be clear, to the
no, audience. I think it's a valid point because I want it. Like, I have these idealistic views of who's like smart and who's not, and I need them.
Well, like, why don't you have stakeholders ask questions? Right? I don't know, people with some skin in the game.
local politicians.
Well, I mean, like, no, anyone who...
The mayor.
So for a question on climate change, right, and climate justice, maybe somebody from the neighborhood being referred to, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of what I was talking about the last time we were talking about the debates for the first debate. And I think that one of the things, like the political reality, though, is, of course, that this is never going to, no one's ever going to agree to face the kinds of questions that would come from the demos, from the unwashed masses. So, like, what would be the best mediation of that? I don't know. I mean, I think... One question, what, like, could we do debate by sortition? Like, could we, like, add in, like, that radical democracy thing of being like, we have a bunch of questions and we're going to pull them at random? I mean, that is, like, that would be the radical democratic way to have a presidential debate, which is an oxymoron because, you know, it's not a radical institution to have presidents at all. But I think that we're never going to get to that. So if you have to kind of remain in the tranche of like recognized established elites, maybe something like the Nobel Prize would have more, I would say like more unexpectedness in it, which might be the best thing that you could hope for. That like the Nobel Prize laureates are themselves quite a strange bunch. You know, if you like put them all together, they don't all kind of believe the same thing. But I think it would be maybe difficult in this country because the Nobel Prizes aren't awarded on the base by this country. So what would be like maybe the American, the highest American, like the Academy?
National
Academy of Sciences? I don't know.
The Kennedy Center Honors.
Yeah. So, well, then they're not as interesting a bunch, but there you go.
Sorry. I don't have anything. That's why I said that.
But I kind of like that idea of like the like a broad sense of expertise, maybe not like the brain trust, but like just like a broad kind of random selection of experts, maybe more like the celebrity model of The Voice or America's Got Talent, of just like a panel of famous people. I mean, anything would be better.
Blake Shelton would be a hell of a moderator. I stand by that.
Ex-presidents in chairs that turn around, the ex-presidents, they hit the, I'm going to vote for you, and the chair flips around.
Amazing. What I'm picturing with Tim's like random questions is like essentially like a big bingo, like a big cylinder full of bingo balls, and you like pull one out and you get your questions. This one's from George F. in Vermont. What will you do about the fact that Sonic is always advertising near me, but there aren't any Sonics in my state? As the president of the United States, what will you do about that? Yeah. Like issues we all really care about.
Yeah, I think, well, just to like very briefly talk about randomness and democracy and how that might inform our kind of thinking about debate and maybe for the people who listen to this podcast who are interested in like college debating or tournament debate. I know that that's no, but nobody on this podcast cares about that. Maybe the people listen to it do. Randomness has become in a scientific culture a theory of sampling, of like a random sample that gives you something that's represented. representative. But in like ancient Athens, where sortition was being used as a democratic principle, they have no idea, no concept that's even close to that. So for them, randomness is a kind of like they understand the chanciness of it, which means that when you kind of rely upon randomness, you become responsible for the worst people in your society. And wouldn't that be nice? Because we have some pretty terrible people in this society. So like if we had a reason and like a reason to be like, not just feel like superior to people that were bad, but like maybe those bad people would be in control of our lives. Oh, guess what? They are. That like maybe a society that was more experienced with not just the controlled and representative sense of what happens, the mid-Atlantic accent that comes out of the cable news, but that kind of strange weirdness of America, and be like, oh my God, do people in my country think that would be the actual use of something like mass media in a debate, to show you how weird and strange are the questions and feelings and opinions of other people that apparently are part of some of the same political unit that you are a part of. So what we need is a broader representation of difference, and not in just this kind of like, you know, diversity talk that we have now that we all like that gets used to really once again just kind of smooth over all of those differences because it becomes representative. It's about the real weird and eccentric elements of the society that we have to become more familiar with, because otherwise we don't understand ourselves. And the kind of democracy we live in is at peril because of its false representation as that kind of clean moderator, polished millionaire anchors talking to each other in the spin room after a debate.
Yeah, I think that's great. You know, that's why I really liked watching the debates on C-SPAN, because they would just open the phones and there would be like Steve Scully or somebody and be like, how do you feel if you're a Republican, this number, if you're a Democrat, this number, if you're independent, this number? And then yeah, they would just have the craziest people come on there. And I loved listening to that. And that's exactly what you're suggesting. But, you know, they tried to do that. They had that YouTube debate. They tried to do these things, but they were heavily filtered and edited. You know, out of how many questions were sent in, which ones did they choose? They chose the ones that suited their purposes.
And so we will never get a question on male circumcision.
Right. There you go. Right.
They're at every protest, though, so like they're definitely part of this. They're activists.
There you go. Yeah. Would you ban male genital mutilation, Mr. President? That's the question.
I don't know. I actually think that's like a. I mean, we're laughing about it, and of course this is just as impractical than of the other suggestions, and even crazier, less likely to happen. But I think as an image of like what democracy would look like, you can have something that's impractical. You know, when Thomas More wrote Utopia still has the kind of constraints of having to be a society that has difference and has its own kind of politics in
it.
Yep. And I think if we imagine like a utopian vision of a debate, isn't a debate where everything goes well? Like, what would that even mean? I think that's that vision of utopia, of everything going well, is kind of why we got the debate tonight. Oh, if we just muted Trump, we would be able to have something more that's more reasonable, more civil. And that's what we got. And what it ended up being was a clearer representation of the despair that we face.
Yeah,
that's how
sure.
I felt.
Yeah.
And what would be better is kind of an imagination that's regulative around the real kinds of differences that we have in this country, which are far more colorful and strange and unpredictable than the ones that were represented on the stage tonight.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. It's like eating a chicken that's been cooked to 140 degrees in the middle of it, but it has no seasoning.
My favorite kind.
Cooked perfectly and inedible.
The two-party system. A chicken with no seasoning.
Cooked perfectly. No. Cooked perfectly and unseasoned. The Commission on Presidential Debates. Man, those people. Did you see their speeches at the beginning of it? God. The commission needs to go. It's time to decommission the presidential debates. This is what we need to do. We need to push Congress to get rid of equal time, get rid of fairness. And just have people do these debates whenever they want, however they want to do them. Maybe we'll lose them forever, but that wouldn't be such a big loss, I'm thinking. But I think the commission, I mean, even after the fixes, quote-unquote fixes of everything, from I mean, it's just been a disaster of a year. I really feel like the commission has not met their own goals of voter education. I mean, you listen to them talk before the debate. What did they present? Well, millions of people report that they enjoy these. Around the world, fledgling democracies are copying this debate style. That's not a positive thing.
dear God.
That's not positive. You don't want, I mean, is this, I mean, they basically said we are good because we're in the service of imperialism, of the exporting of democracy. And people like this. And I mean, there was just no kind of hint at research, no kind of indicator from the co-chairs of the commission that they have any evidence that they're educating voters. I don't even know if they've done any research. There's nothing on their website that indicates this. The only thing that has some kind of plan on their website is the only thing they ever get burned for, and that is third-party inclusion. They have a metric for determining third-party. They're very clear about that. Like, do you have at least 15% nationally? Can you actually win an electoral vote? And it's like these double standards and stuff to where only the two parties would ever be included. That standard.
Except one crazy rich guy from Texas runs that one time.
No, he's the reason the standard exists.
Yeah, I know.
They didn't have a standard before. They were just like, yeah, let's throw him in. And then in 96, he was in and then out. And, I mean, you know, they got egg on their face. But what are they preserving? What are they trying to preserve? I mean, I don't know. I kind of feel like it's time to imagine or reconsider the commission's monopoly on these events. Or maybe we'd be better off without them. The foundation of these things was voter education, national discussion on the issues. I mean, Adlai Stevenson couldn't predict podcasting. I mean, do we have sufficient national discussion on the issues? Does this retard national discussion on the issues? Are they counterproductive? I think this is counterproductive.
You might be right about that. I think if their goal is to educate the populace, I think one of the biggest problems other than the format is the temporal problem of when these debates occur. You want to actually make them something that the populace like listens to and like it makes voting decisions based on. Do it a week after the DNC and RNC are over. Make this the first big public event other than after the primary there where these campaigns are actually releasing large portions of their national like campaign strategy like against one another. I think that would, if your goal is voter education, why is it happening 2 weeks before election day? It makes absolutely no sense. Like, you're doing it at a time when most people have made up their minds, as opposed to a point where if people hadn't paid attention through the primary cycle, which is a probably higher amount of people than we'd want to admit, they would actually get a contrast between the two candidates, potentially, if it was happening almost immediately after they got the nomination.
And I'm just, like, imagining the world where what the debate actually gives you is high-quality education on these issues and where people stand. So, like, okay, so you're telling me in the course of an hour and a half, we are going to get deep into the questions of COVID, our foreign policy, our deep-seated issues with race, our immigration system, and climate change. So we're just going to
Don't forget the ACA. There's plenty of room.
Right.
I mean, God, we didn't even talk about court packing. What a missed opportunity for Trump again.
I think you're right, Kate. That I just came up with, so I'm sure they're really good because I just thought of them.
If
podcasts are the model, then obviously, you know, as you said, the presidential candidates themselves won't debate. But the presidential candidates are really typically mouthpieces for their campaign. And so here are maybe two ways that we could have alternatives to the presidential debates, because we don't really have any power or influence over changing that. One would be to have prominent supporters of the different candidates come on and defend their candidate. And typically, I think that prominent supporters of candidates are far more, often more versed in what the campaign's rhetoric and platform and issues are than the candidates themselves. And the candidates themselves have less freedom to say certain things because of the fact that they're running a national campaign. So maybe having, like, you know, recruiting people who are prominent advocates and having those kinds of debates, having more of those, and just having, like, you know, the Thousand Flowers kind of version of just a bunch of different debates and different podcasts would be good. Another one would be to use the kind of ambitious and sleazy kinds of personalities that are often on these campaigns to our own democratic advantage. Because I think all democratic policy needs to be thought not from people's virtues, but from people's worst motivations. And a lot of these people are very kind of narcissistic and would like to be heard if they had the chance, even though that maybe they have various kinds of legal reasons that they can't be heard. So maybe trying to scoop campaigns by, actually going to people that are working on the campaigns rather than the candidates themselves, and having like a kind of page six that of political gossip that's devoted to campaigns' response to serious political questions rather than just what's happening. That might be a way of making celebrity gossip actually useful to the democracy. Anyway, these are just random thoughts.
No, that second one is actually pretty good, because that slack is picked up by, you know, for-profit entertainment industries like the Munk Debates and Intelligence Squared. And, you know, they have an agenda. I mean, I'm sure that they are well-meaning in their hearts, but they bring on popular big figures because the people will pay to sit in the same room with them and hear them talk. And it might not necessarily be the best people to do that. Newton Minow, I've got to point out, also said that part of the commission that should be enforced is that you have debates in off-election years. That should be part of the commission's job, and they don't do that. And that was part of the initial report that framed the commission. So another reason to cancel.
I do think there's probably some good that would happen through like Tim's idea by having just more of the people surrounding the campaign talk about it. My main worry for that would just be that like, you just have the campaign surrogates start to sound the same way that the candidates do, and they'd be overprepared and overpolished and wouldn't say anything interesting. And I think the biggest problem with all of this is I have to listen to Rudy Giuliani talk more.
I wasn't necessarily imagining surrogates. I was kind of imagining like civil society groups that have made, you know, have like pledged allegiance to their campaign.
Auto workers union.
It could be trade unions, it could be the NRA, it could be anybody. And these are people often brought on cable news in order to defend certain things that are relevant to them in this kind of very direct journalistic way. But imagine having a debate with these civil society organizations in which those who they have endorsed, once they've given a public endorsement, so they have some reason to defend it, are asked to defend their candidates. And I think that might give like just a little bit of a different angle of people being like, we are the candidates, and so vote for me, or I endorse them, and it's just a kind of, I endorse them because they're better than the other guy. But to ask people who have given public and prominent endorsements how they defend their candidate on a variety of issues, I think that might be more revealing than actually asking the candidates directly. That's my pitch.
Well, we're going to have to end it there. We're out of time, but you guys want to do this in 4 years?
No.
No,
absolutely not.
We're done.
I want to do it tonight. So
yeah, well, there you go. Well, in 4 years, you might feel better.
No,
in four years, debate might be banned by the directorate, the United States Safety Directorate. No more debate or talk.
Look, don't talk about Emperor Trump that way.
Or more likely, it's like, well, you just bought the regular version of Democracy. The debate DLC is $59.99.
Well, look, I really learned a lot while having a great time.
Really?
That's right, because I am talking about Bobcat Chat and outreach.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
By the Rhode Island Department of Environmental Management, which I enjoyed earlier today.
You know, if you want to get the Bobcat Chat people, if you can get them, we'll have them on the show. How do you argue about this kind of wildlife? People want to kill these things. How do you persuade them not to?
Oh, that's the bigger issue for them is coyotes, but...
Yeah, let's talk about that, you know? Let's talk about that. That's fine, too. Get them on the show. It'll be great. Anyway, thanks for...
to the Rhode Island Department of Environmental Management's YouTube page.
Well, now, you gotta reach out to them, you, as a representative of the program. We'll have the Bobcat Chat people on. I don't mind.
Steve, before we adjourn this, I have something I want to address.
Go ahead.
Okay. On the last podcast...
This is always so dangerous. Why do I always say okay to George? I never learn. Go ahead, George.
Vice presidential debates. I may have said previously that I believed that the state of Idaho did not exist. Despite the controversy these comments caused, I fully stand by the statements I have made.
Oh God. All right. Well, anyway, good night, everyone. Thank you for listening. Anchor.fm/inthebend. Lots of episodes there. inthebendpodcast.com. Lots of episodes and commentary there. We'd love to hear from you. So drop us a line or leave us a little voice chat on Anchor. And thank you, Tim. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, George. I am Dr. Steve Yano. Thanks for listening. And we hope that you enjoy this and many of our other fine episodes. And we will catch you on the next one. Good night.